It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. It's coming up later, the case that we make too many judgments based on our read of a person's face.
First, we're continuing our series of congressional candidate forums here on Central Time. Yesterday, we heard from both candidates running for the state's second congressional district seat.
We also heard from Ron Gritt, the Democratic challenger in the race for the state's 8th congressional district seat. We now turn to his opponent in that race, who's seeking another term as the representative in northeastern Wisconsin. Reed Ribble is a former small business owner and the Republican congressman representing the state's 8th congressional district. He joins us now by phone. Congressman Ribble, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, to start, why are you running for another term in Congress?
Well, I think there's still some work to be done. The reason I ran in the first place was to the degree that I could affect change as it relates to the nation's deficit spending and the direction our economy was headed. I wanted to do that, and there's still more work to be done there. The economy can still grow. Some of the obstacles that have been put in place by government to allow our economy to grow are still in place. There's been progress made on the deficit for sure, but I want to continue to complete that work.
When people think of Congress, they'll think often of gridlock, political bickering. There are low approval ratings for the institution as a whole. Make the case that you can help bridge those gaps and get some things done.
No, I think their perception is based in reality. Certainly, there's a level of gridlock because there's differences in opinions between the two chambers of the Congress. The House and Senate have not been effective in working together. Right now, there are over 300-plus pieces of legislation that have been passed by the United States House of Representatives that have not been voted on by Senate Democrats. And so I think the American people will ultimately make a determination as to whether or not who's responsible for that. However, I think when I went there, I was struck by the fact that it seemed very difficult for me as a Republican to reach across the aisle and find willing members to work with. But through a little bit of diligence, through taking some folks out to dinner, to setting up meetings, I was able to start a group with Congressman Kurt Schrader from Oregon, who's a Democrat from Oregon, called the Problem Solvers Caucus. We started with four of us, and by the end of this term, we'll have over 100 of us meeting together. We try to grow it equally between Democrats and Republicans. So if you're a Republican and you want to join our caucus, you have to bring a Democrat colleague. If you're a Democrat, you have to bring a Republican colleague with you. And those meetings have been extraordinarily beneficial to building trust and understanding for the two political ideologies that are there.
Before we move on to particular issues, looking back in your first years in Congress, what are you most proud of? What, in hindsight, do you think you could have done differently?
Yeah, you know, I think for the fact that as far as what I'm most proud of, I think it's the completion of the highway bill. When you look at what had happened in the prior years, it was extension after extension after extension. And we were finally able to get MAP 21, the current highway bill, passed into law. It was a two-year bill that solidified America's infrastructure. And it changed how we go about infrastructure projects. There was a lot of streamlining that took place in that piece of legislation. 95 pages of the streamlining was my own language that came out of my office. And we reduced the construction time and project time from an average of 15 years down to 7, and that has is significant savings in the billions of dollars for American taxpayers. And the increased work that can be done for those dollars is really significant. So I would say that that's one of the highlights of the time that I've been in Congress as far as big accomplishments. And then things that I would like to have seen done different, we still have an ongoing entitlement crisis, in my opinion. By 2032, the actuaries are telling us Social Security will be insolvent around the same time or just shorter than that. Medicare goes insolvent. The Social Security Disability Trust Fund goes insolvent in roughly 14 or 15 months. And the Congress has not been able to act on those. And so that's troubling to me that we've not been able to fix those.
Well, let's follow up on that. What would you like to see happen with Social Security to extend its lifespan
even
further?
Yeah, you know, well, ultimately, I think you have to take a look at it. Since every single American participates in the program, every single American should participate in its reform. And while some people say, well, we should just raise the amount of tax subject the amount of income subject to the tax. Well, that's a good idea, and that gets you about 30% of the way there, but it ends up being a 30% solution for a 100% problem, and it's often divided by political lines. Democrats will often say, well, just raise the tax. Republicans will say, well, Americans need to work longer, or we need to change the cost of living adjustment and all those things. In reality, it's probably going to take a combination of all those things to get to a 100% solution for a 100% problem. And what that will do by spreading the cost across all 300 million Americans, hardly anybody has to bear a lot more burden, but all of us bear a little more burden so that my 8- and 10-year-old grandchildren are secure in knowing that Social Security will be for them as well as current seniors. And so we take care of current seniors and future seniors by getting at a big reform that covers all those bases.
Well, when we're talking about elections, whether here in Wisconsin or nationwide, jobs and the economy loom large. Let's start with job creation. What role do you think Congress could and should play in boosting job creation here in the state and around the country?
Yeah, well, certainly I think anything that we do nationally will affect Wisconsin ultimately. And so I look at the barriers or the friction points that are put in place by government that slow the economy down. And they're centered around things like tort policy, regulation policy, taxation policy. It would be one thing if our corporate tax rates were competitive inside this hemisphere, much less globally, and we're not competitive in either place. And so if we would get serious about fixing our transportation infrastructure, changing tort in this country, getting at trade agreements, making sure that taxation is fair and competitive globally, and having a regulatory regime that actually has a fair and level playing field for both large and small companies, I think we could make a lot of progress on economic growth, and the economy would actually just really expand very aggressively.
When it comes to tax reform, a lot of people argue that, well, we may have this higher level of corporate taxation than many of our neighbors in this hemisphere, as you say, but who actually pays that? Does it balance out when you check out the loopholes and deductions that are available?
Yeah, well, you have to remember that most corporate taxes are paid by individuals who have passed through companies. About 90% of America's businesses are held in either limited liability corporations or in subchapter S corporations, where the entire corporate profit gets passed on to the shareholders, which are, by the way, relatively few people for each company. And then those individuals must pay the corporate tax rate, which, by the way, right now is around 44% if they're at the maximum rate. And so it doesn't get passed out around equally. Large multinational corporations are typically paying somewhere in the 27 to 33%, the maximum rate at 35%. But if we compare that to what the Canadians are doing just to our north, one of our primary competitors in this hemisphere, they're at 15%. So no matter how you structure your corporation in the U.S., you're not even remotely close to what the Canadians are doing.
So it's going to be a big, messy piece of legislation to change that. Do you see a prospect for bipartisan cooperation between a Republican House and Democratic Senate or Republican Congress and Democratic President?
I think it's more likely that it could happen if it's a Republican Congress than a Democrat Senate. I think that our best opportunity to get it to getting to legitimate tax reform, where one side or one political party isn't jamming down the throats of the other party their particular ideology or ideas, in a divided government where the Congress is controlled by one party and the White House controlled by the other, seems to be the best operating model. And in fact, the last time real tax reform happened was under President Reagan, when the dynamic was reversed. You had a Democrat Congress and a Republican president, and they were able to find a point of compromise. And President Obama has sent out several olive branches in relationship to the tax code that he'd like to see, things that Republicans agree with. I believe that we might be able to have an opportunity. There's a very good chance that Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin will become the next chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which writes tax policy for the House of Representatives, and Wisconsin will be at the forefront of drafting that policy.
We're talking right now with Republican Congressman Reid Ribble. He's up for re-election in Wisconsin's 8th congressional district seat, and he faces Democrat Ron Gritt in next week's election. If you've got a question for Congressman Ribble or wondering where he stands on a particular issue, you can call now at 800-642-1110. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Congressman Reid Ribble. He's the Republican incumbent candidate running for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District seat. If you've got a question for him or you want to hear his thoughts on an issue, you can give a call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to the phones now. We've got William on the line in Oconomowoc. William, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? My question would be, he talking about giving all these corporations such tax breaks. What about the middle-class citizen who's paying most of the taxes? And if I remember correctly, Romney taxes was half of what my taxes is right now. I just want him to comment on that.
Thanks for the call, William. Congressman Ribble, middle-class personal income taxes versus upper-class.
Yeah. That's a fair question to be asked. One of the basic key points that he brings up here is the disparity in the tax code whereby investment income, in particular capital gains income, is taxed at a different rate than regular income or earned income. And so as a result of that, a higher affluent wage earner can end up having a much lower tax rate. Now, I don't know exactly where policy is going to reside as it comes to individual tax rates, but I think at the end of the day, if you can get that top marginal rate down low enough, let's say maybe capped at around 25% rather than 35%, you would then be able to take all income and treat it actually the same. And because right now capital gains can be taxed at around 15 to 17%. And so we've got a tax code that says to Americans that if you're working to make it in America, you pay a higher rate. If you've made it in America, you pay a lower rate. And I think what you want to do is take that manipulation out of the tax code and simplify it so that no matter where that income comes from, it's treated the same under tax policy. That way, those who are trying to actually make it in America are not treated unfairly, as what the caller just alluded to. As it relates to corporate taxes, I'm not advocating some big corporate tax giveaway. I am cognizant, however, that corporate taxation is paid by somebody, and it's typically paid either by customers if the marketplace will allow prices to go up, or it's paid by labor. And this is one of the big fallacies in understanding tax policy and how businesses work, is that they say, well, you're just giving a big tax break to businesses. Well, not really. There's a compression of middle-class wages in this country right now, in part due to high corporate tax rates. And so if corporations cannot move within the marketplace to move pricing up to offset the tax burden, then they capture that pricing by compressing wages. And we're seeing that play out in real time right now.
Moving to a related issue, the federal budget deficit, our annual deficits have gone down some in recent years. The debt overall, though, continues to grow up. Your thoughts on fixing that?
Yeah, as long as we have deficit spending, the debt's going to continue to go up. People always ask me and challenge me to cut waste, fraud, and abuse, and I'm all for it. But one of the biggest wasteful things that we have is the $260 billion we're paying in interest on the national debt right now. And so we have to get to a place where we can get to structural balance, whereby revenues align itself with how much money we're actually spending on the way out. It's difficult to get to, though, because members of Congress have their hands tied by law. And by that I mean all entitlement programs, which would include Social Security, Medicare, veterans benefits, things like that, are protected by written law and cannot be touched without changing the underlying law. So you actually have to reform the program to bring those into balance. And other things that would be required or mandatory spending would also be interest on the national debt. That's about 65% of all federal spending, so the Congress only has control of about 35% of spending. And as more and more Americans age and go into retirement, this problem gets exacerbated over time. And so we're going to have to continue to modify those things that are causing a slowdown in the economy to increase economic growth. I talked about that a moment ago. And when you do that, more revenue comes into the Treasury, driving that deficit down.
Moving on to health care, the House of Representatives, Republicans in the House have voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act a number of times. That didn't get through the Senate, wouldn't get through the White House. Would you like to see the Affordable Care Act repealed, or are there specific changes you'd like to see, accepting that it might be here for a while anyway?
Well, I'm a realist as it comes to the Affordable Care Act, in that as long as President Obama's in the White House, a full-blown repeal is not likely to happen, because he's going to veto any repeal, and there's not going to be the numbers to override a veto. And I've been an advocate here in the last couple of years of providing reforms inside the Affordable Care Act. I couldn't care less if it's called the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or whatever, as long as we get at the core issues that are driving health care costs up. And here in Wisconsin, it has a lot to do with availability of supply of health care. One of the fallacies of the Affordable Care Act is it made the claim that it is equal to have access to insurance is equal to having access to care. And having access to insurance is irrelevant if there are not enough doctors to provide the services in various places around the state of Wisconsin. I represent the northeast part of Wisconsin. It's a very rural district that is underserved by health care providers. And there isn't adequate providers in many places in northeast Wisconsin and all of northern Wisconsin. And so now we're requiring people to pay for an insurance product, but they might have to wait months to get actual care because there's not enough supply. Where we should have been directing our efforts was on inducing more students to go into healthcare, to increase the number of primary care doctors, increase the number of nurses, so that the supply of healthcare would go up and get in balance with the ever-increasing demand here in this country. As long as those are out of balance, you're going to continue to see prices go up. So any discussion that we have as it relates to healthcare in this country must first look at the issue of supply and demand. It's the only way you're going to get control over it.
Moving to immigration, both houses of Congress have passed their own versions of some kind of immigration laws. Nothing has come out of that, though. What would you like to see happen on immigration?
Yeah, I've said right from the very beginning, back in 2009 when I first decided to run for Congress, that it's very difficult, and it was proven back in 2005, 2006, to pass a comprehensive immigration bill. The larger the text of that bill, when you get into 2,000, 2,500 pages, it is so complex that buried inside that text are always going to be poison pills for members of the House. And so, therefore, you should do this sequentially, taking the individual titles of the Senate bill, writing them from a House version of it. So the Title I is on border security. The House should pass its own border security bill. It should pass its own version of the DREAM Act. It should pass its own version of what highly skilled immigration reform should be and immigration reform for low-skilled workers. Pass them sequentially, because you will get 218 votes for each element of it, but they won't be the same 218 members. And then over the course of time, you would get to a full comprehensive solution that actually can get to the president's desk.
But the worry from Democrats, I think, is that if you have an a la carte approach, Republicans in the House will say, sure, quick vote on border security. And then the reform stuff, the path to citizenship angle maybe doesn't get passed.
Well, they can take that posture. But how has their posture worked so far? They've got the same conflict with the House Republicans saying we're not going to take up a full-blown comprehensive bill. What they're going to have to do is figure out how to compromise with us and move something so that you can get to step two. What I hear from most House Republicans is that if we can get a border that's secure and we feel comfortable with those security measures, they're much more open to doing the rest of the package, because then we know that what has gone on since 1986 or 85, when the last immigration reform bill was passed, won't be repeatable. And so you have to have the border security and interior enforcement mechanisms in play to get Republicans to vote for those other elements. If you do that, I'm very confident that that'll happen.
In just a few moments, ISIS remains probably the top foreign policy priority right now. What are your thoughts briefly on airstrikes and possible ground troops in the future there from the U.S.?
Right now, the strategy by the commander has been to go strictly with airstrikes in support of the Free Syrian Army, the Iraqi Defense Forces, and the Kurdish Defense Forces. As time goes on here over the next several months, we're going to see if that strategy is going to be effective in stopping ISIS. Initially, they were under the idea that if we shut off all the supply lines through airstrikes, in other words, if they cannot resupply with new weapons, new arms, and food, then we could, in essence, starve out ISIS inside Iraq. But they've not been successful in doing that because there's too much free movement at night and in areas that you can't fully cover. So will it end up with troops on the ground? I can't say at this point, but it would not surprise me if at some point the president doesn't come to the Congress and ask for additional authorization to do so, at least with special forces.
Congressman Ribble, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was good to be with you. Thank you.
That was Republican Congressman Reed Ribble up for re-election in Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. His opponent is Democrat Ron Gritt. We talked to him yesterday on the program. You can check out all of our candidate forums over at wisconsinvote.org.